Welcome to Parenting During the Pandemic, a podcast brought to you by the Parent Encouragement Program, or PEP as it's more commonly known. I'm your host, Robbie Fox, a certified parent educator with PEP. We first introduced this podcast during the spring of 2020 when parents were facing the daunting challenges of families living, working, schooling, and playing under one roof and searching for ways to thrive. As issues of the nation's racial inequality came to the fore earlier this summer, many parents began embarking on yet another search for guidance. This one on cultivating racial and cultural awareness in their families. To address these challenges, PEP created a new webinar series titled Critical Topics in Parenting to address the pressing issues facing parents today. This series will feature five webinars from August through November 2020 that are free to all parents. This is in addition to the 11 free webinars that PEP introduced in spring 2020 to address parenting support during the coronavirus, on a wide range of parenting strategies to help during the pandemic. You can find details for all of these programs at www.pepparent.org. To help me introduce our new series on critical topics in parenting, I'm very happy to be joined today by my fellow PEP co-leader, Carol Mileta, who will moderate two webinars in this free series. Carol is the founder of the Parenting 411, a portal where she engages parents, taking them from overwhelmed to overjoyed. She guides them in building strong family connections and fostering their children's success in academics and life. She was named 2019 DC Mother of the Year by American Mothers, Inc. She is co-founder of a parent education and consulting company where she designs parenting programs and privately consults with families. Carol hosts the Parenting 411 radio show, where she explores various matters affecting family life from discipline and communications to work-life harmony and co-parenting. She was named Radio Personality of the Year at SpeakerCon 2019. Carol is a contributing author of Courageous Enough to Launch, Stories and Strategies of Everyday Women Who Face Their Fears to Launch Thriving Businesses. And she is author of the upcoming book, Mother's Work, Pearls of Wisdom and Gems from My Journey. Carol and her husband are the proud parents of two young adult sons. On August 24th, Carol will moderate the first webinar in the series, White Parents, Let's Talk, Doing Our Part to End Racism, featuring Karen Fleshman, author and founder of Racy Conversations. In October, Carol will co-present with Dr. Linda McGee another program in the series called Cultivating Racial and Cultural Awareness in Children. I thoroughly enjoyed my conversation with Carol as she offered guidance on how to listen, reflect, and guide our children when talking about racism. So I want to welcome Carol. I've had the opportunity of interacting with Carol through our work with the Parent Encouragement Program, though I don't think we ever have actually taught together.
I think that's right.
Yeah. I joined you on your radio show at one point, and I say you have quite a bit more experience interviewing people than I have. So I appreciate you being willing to sit in the guest chair this time. So speaking today again about social injustice and racism and what parents can do to kind of further our families, our nation along this journey. So Carol, I guess I'd like to start off by asking you a bit about your own thoughts about where our country is currently. And if or how you perceive it to be different than the periods following the deaths of, say, Rodney King, which was, gosh, all the way back in 1991, Freddie Gray, and just the many others who have lost their lives these many years, and now following the deaths of George Floyd and Breonna Turner, where do you think we are, and are we farther along?
Well, I definitely think we are farther along. And I see this time as different from the periods following Rodney King and Freddie Gray and the others. Now, to give a little background, I was living in Southern California for a work assignment during and after the trial of the officers who assaulted Rodney King.
Wow, I didn't realize that.
What I saw among white people during that time was a willingness to believe that he must have done something to cause the officers to need to handle him in that matter, because police officers are always right. And so even with the video, there shouldn't have been room for doubt. Now, I will be fair and say that the quality of that video was as good as we could get at the time, but it was just fuzzy enough for people to say that, look, it's not crystal clear. We don't know what happened before the camera turned on. We're not sure what we're seeing. And so surely there had to be something that could explain why the officers did that. And then, of course, they moved the trial out of LA, away from where the incident happened, out to Simi Valley. And that was a predominantly white suburb where those residents could never imagine policemen acting out of order. And so there was no way that those officers were going to be convicted, and they certainly weren't. So I would say this sentiment carried forward to other incidents as well involving unarmed Black people. And then what you started to see in print or, you know, social media as that was growing, that, you know, if only Black people would stop committing crimes in the first place or don't resist, right? And, you know, whether they've done anything or not, these incidents wouldn't happen if, you know, if it wasn't, if they weren't committing crimes, if they weren't resisting. And that includes like Michael Brown and Freddie Gray. And then you add to that, that if there's anything that the media can dig up about the victims, then it makes it justified. Like, I mean, we already know that their mugshots will be shown. Like, for example, you know, I saw a story today about a man stealing $2 million in funding, you know, coronavirus funding for businesses, but where's his mugshot, right? And so that's the kind of thing that happens with people who are Black that are involved in some sort of law enforcement incident. So, so you know, still, it's surprising that even with smartphones and cameras and recordings, many people were still just not willing to believe. But I think that the differences we're seeing today could be attributed to some key things. Now we've got three progressively skeptical cohorts of generations of young folks. Generation X to some extent, but certainly generations Y and Z, who have grown up with more diverse friends. They've been exposed from the very beginning to a little more diverse media. So they're not buying what we're trying to tell them about a whole lot of things, but certainly not race and gender stereotypes. And so then you combine that with the compelling image of George Floyd with Derek Chauvin with his knee on his neck, his hands in his pockets, you know, adjusting his position to make himself more comfortable while George is laying on the ground, begging for his life, calling for his deceased mother. And it was just too much. I mean, I think people just took to the streets, including Simi Valley in California.
And my house things have changed.
Right. And people couldn't unsee that. Like, I personally have not watched the full video. I you know, I already know it's real and it's been happening for decades and centuries, but I just can't traumatize myself further to prove something that I already know is true. And so I think that's what happened here. All of those things, and it has a lot to do with these younger generations that are just like, what? You know, how are you all tolerating this? This is wrong. So I think that helped.
So it's interesting you say that. I was listening to Michelle Obama's, you know, her new podcast, and she just did the episode last week with her friend and journalist, Michelle Norris, who anchors All Things Considered on NPR. And I really appreciate how she described the journey to social justice and equality as a relay race, where we are continuing to pass on the baton essentially to the next generation, to the generation X, Y, and Z. I'd like to think our generation still has work to do and that we still have the time and energy with which to do that. I guess I'm considered a baby boomer, but Generation Jones, the late baby boomer in, which is something I just learned.
I just made it in.
right. So I'd like to think, you know, that our time hasn't passed, right? That we still have the time and energy and resources that we can still do the work to further
our nation and our world towards social justice. But I have also been thinking more about the resources I should have been passing along and the conversations I should have been having when my kids were younger. Now they're young adults, so that they can get us closer to that, you know, proverbial finish line, whatever that may look like. And, you know, I was, when the kids were younger, I thought it was, you know, we were sort of trained to, there was politer to say, or more appropriate, I guess, to say African-American versus Black or brown, that we weren't supposed to see color. Very blessed in my family to have had two biracial family members join our family through adoption. One of whom just got married this past weekend, and my son officiated it. But you know, I've learned more recently that that wasn't necessarily the case, that I should have been talking to them about seeing color. So help me a little bit understand that a little bit better, about that the terms African-American versus Black and just the concept of seeing color within those conversations.
Okay, so one thing I'll say is, you know, when you say that you don't see color, and believe me, some of the coolest white folks I know, some of the that I'm really fond of, and they had that view too. They thought they were doing the right thing with that as well. So you're definitely not alone. But when you say that, you're taking something off the table. Like, we're not gonna, you know, because, and you're like almost normalizing us to you. Like, and it's all, and it's making you feel better. You think you're making us feel better, but it's making you feel better. And so that's a big part of it. I mean, because our color and our experiences, that's part of us. We're proud of it. Like, don't take it off the table. And this point was really driven home to me back when I was researching, my business partner and I were researching for a course we were about to present about cultural awareness. And we read a book by Jaya John, and I want to say it was Black Baby, White Hands. And so he was adopted by white parents. Wonderful people. And the way they were raising him, though, it was really like, well, we love you. We don't see color. And he's like, you don't see color? I mean, it's a part of who I am. It's what people see every day. It's a part of my experience. Like, don't take that part of me away. I mean, I don't say that, you know, it's almost like saying we're going to ignore a gift you have. You know, let's just not look at that. So that's the problem there with that, for sure. See it. We want you to see it and welcome it and see that it's not right or wrong. It's just different. And then keep in mind, you're different to us.
Right.
So, yeah. So it's just embracing it and just recognizing that there are all kinds of people that make up this world, and we can work together. We all have gifts to bring to this world.
One thing I've noticed now in reading media coverage of different events, I notice that if it's involving a person of color, they describe them as a Black person, or, you know, if it's not a person, well, it's a person of color, white, because white is a color, that's left out.
Yeah,
and I had never noticed that until recently.
That
the assumption is they're white unless described as otherwise.
Right, and that's the same thing where I was telling you about that story this morning. Fox 5 posted a story about this person taking the funding, the small business funding that people were given to ride out this whole pandemic, you know, took $2 million. And of course you go look at the story and there's no sign of him. No picture of this guy. Mm-hmm. And so, and that's what the comments were like, oh, okay, where's the mugshot? Who is this guy? So we, you know, we're pretty much left with he's white. And I can guarantee when he is shown, we're going to see his picture, his corporate picture, his LinkedIn picture.
Right.
And maybe, hey, maybe his graduation picture. We've seen that as well, where a grown man, you know, 35, 45-year-old man, they reached back and found his graduation picture
rather
to
than
avoid showing the mugshot.
Wow. Wow. These are those subtle things that have made such a huge imprint. And I think that until it's kind of brought to your attention and it's sad. What about the term African American versus Black or brown?
I'm Black. I will say that during my young adult years, you know, through the 90s even, I tried to roll with African American. But I'm just back to Black. I mean, we don't have European Americans. Irish-American,
right.
You know, or
right.
Even, you know, breaking it down further, Irish-American, Italian-Americans, or whatever. So right. I'm back to Black and have been for quite a few years.
Okay. you know, it's I think sometimes in our effort to be so politically correct, we trip all over ourselves. But thank you for that clarification. So at PEP, you know, we hold classes on how to talk with our teens and tweens about sensitive topics, such as drugs, alcohol, sexual identity, you know, activity, consent, but I've never, at least in my teachings, talked with parents about how to talk with our kids about social injustice and inequality, and our role in sort of stopping it or at least stop perpetuating it. And I'm recognizing how much more I could have done. Those conversations I could have had growing up, other than just, like you said, normalizing Black people, which was not nearly what I should have been doing. So as the mother of Black males, however, you had to have conversations around that. I wonder if you would mind sharing a little bit about those conversations you've had through the years with your own boys and about what it means to be a Black male in our country.
Okay. So definitely in the books we read and any media we consumed, whether it's movies or whatever, we certainly educated them from an early age and at an age appropriate way about slavery and Harriet Tubman and what was Martin Luther King doing and all of that. So we definitely did that all along. And then, but of course, we had these conversations very early, and frankly, the boys probably didn't even know we were having these conversations when I would tell them how to conduct themselves when dealing with their teachers and going to their friends' houses for play dates. And of course, I mean, we taught them good manners for the sake of having good manners, but in the back of my mind was always the fact that I didn't want folks making assumptions about them because they were Black. So, you know, I always wanted to make sure they were good advocates for themselves, could speak clearly about any concerns or any needs that they had, so there'd be no mistake. And I didn't teach them to be subservient or anything, but I just wanted them to be able to speak up for themselves in a respectful way, and you know, not feeling like they don't deserve to speak up for themselves unless they're angry or in danger. I wanted them to feel, I wanted it to be natural to them. And so that's something we practice at home and allowing them to have respectful dialogue with us, even when they might question the way things were, even in our own house. So now as they got older, 10 or 11, and started going places with their friends, like to the mall or, I don't know, to the zoo, any public place, I'd have to tell them flat out, no roughhousing, no running around, no loud talking at the mall or wherever they're going. In other words, don't act your age, basically, because those were all typical behaviors.
Yeah.
But I had to let them know that, you know, you're not, I mean, you know, with the people that you're with, it's just going to look different when you do it. It's going to be okay when they do it. And at that point, our boys were certainly skeptical. They thought, you know, you're just really making stuff up because look, ever since preschool, I've had these friends. diverse sets of friends. I've been to their house, they've been here, you know, Miss So-and-so kisses me every time she sees me, you know, all of this, right? Mm-hmm. And we have a Black president. So, you know, so they didn't believe it. And then in terms of, I mean, yes, they understood our history and all of that. But, you know, look, we had all kinds of Black friends across the socioeconomic spectrum. We had very highly successful, high profile Black friends, well-educated, all of that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it was easy for them to say, think, well, wow, it was like that, but now, you know, it's not. And so they saw all of these people seemingly doing okay and wondered why we were making this big deal until Trayvon Martin.
Right.
Then it was like, oh, so you really can be minding your own business. Right. And I mean, that wasn't exactly a police involved event, even though, you know, the assailant was trying to operate like one almost. But right. Yeah, that was when they could see that, wow, this kind of thing could happen. And you know, I would say for us, maybe not to other people, rapid succession, and you have more people, this happening to more children, young men being shot, you know, just, and then going right on to Michael Brown and all of that. So yeah, that was a real eye opener. It was a sad eye opener, but yes, that's when they started to see, okay, I guess, you know, let's see what you're talking about.
It's kind of validation you really didn't want to have happen. But
right.
Sometimes right. As parents, we do need something outside of our own conversations to verify what it is we're trying to get across to them. So besides the history, you know, which certainly the history of slavery and all those sorts of things were thing, and you know, and Martin Luther King and you know, and those were things obviously we talked to with our kids about and the impact, but it, more in current day. So as you're having those conversations with your sons about how they have to carry themselves differently, what were the conversations that white parents should have been having with their kids that experience?
Speaking about the experience that their Black friends might have been having, or?
Yes, and about how they, you know, obviously speaking about in terms of how incredibly unfair and unjust this is.
Oh.
Yeah, but also, you know, obviously you're having those conversations, but what, let's see how I phrase this. So what, like your son's friends who might have been white, what conversations would you have wanted their parents to be having with their sons about understanding your son's experience?
Oh, well, certainly as things happened, you know, and they saw these news reports and things like that, definitely talking around the dinner table or whatever. I mean, and just not making it a special thing, but frequently, you know, talking about these things, putting it out there. And, you know, and inviting the children to consider how do you think that child, even the child in the real incident, how that child felt and whatever. And then, you know, beyond that, talking around news events or things like that, there should have been diverse books in their homes, in white families' homes. They should see, they should have seen all kinds of children and families and all of that in the books they were reading. Mm-hmm. And then just, it's also just, you know, some of the conversations that parents have, like, you know, when they're talking about a friend at school or whatever, you know, asking things like, well, where do they live? They live over there or whatever, like making assumptions like about their friend, like if they want to have a play date and it's like, oh, where do they live? Over in, you know, some neighborhood where it's all Black, or, you know what I mean? Like jumping to conclusions about what that family would be about, where they'd live, what it's like. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they're questions that you just think might be simple, but you're really implying something there. You know, there's kind of some bias there. Like, for example, my boys were in a T-ball program, and I'm in here where we live. It's a predominantly white neighborhood over in Northern Virginia. And the way they organized that league, they had it so that children, it was organized by elementary school and neighborhood, so that the children would be playing with people they knew, especially since they were young. So, you know, so I'm there watching practice and all of that kind of thing, and would have conversations, you know, with other parents. And so they'd be like, "Oh, so do you live around here?" Well, we know how the program is set up. Of course I live around here.
Right.
You know? And right. So, but I would just answer, "Oh yeah, I live at such and such and such, such street." And they're like, "Oh," and I say, "How about you?" You know what I mean? Because if there's a question about where I live, how about I ask you where, you know, if you live around here? And it was interesting how they would be taken aback. And so it's kind of that. Like, you know, so it's those kinds of questions, those kinds of conversations sometimes we get into with our kids, like where we kind of make these assumptions. And, you know, the beautiful thing about children is they'll call you out about that too. They'll be like, you know, why did you ask that? No, it's, you know, he lives here or he lives there, or yeah, he lives there, you know,
excuse me,
in the black neighborhood or whatever. And yeah, and that's where I want to go Saturday. Like, what's the problem?
Right. Yeah. Well, as you said, fortunately, the next generations are getting it and are understanding those micro aggressions or subtle ways of showing racism. You realize when you really stop and think, it's so obvious. So you are going to be sharing your experience and perspective while moderating PEP's upcoming webinar with Karen Fleshman, who's the author and founder of Racy Conversations. And that's going to focus on what white parents, such as myself, can do to address racism. And I'll share a little bit more details about that podcast in a bit. But this is going to be part of a free series that PEP is sponsoring to address critical and very current topics in parenting. And I know you've been working with the folks at PEP and helping to put this series together. Can you tell listeners a little bit about Karen and offer a little sneak peek of what they might expect to learn from this podcast?
Oh, sure. So Karen is an equity and inclusion strategist. She's also an anti-racism activist, an author, and a founder of Racy Conversations. And so she's very often asked to come into organizations and help them to make their workspaces more inclusive. It's you know, beyond just diversity, but it's really about real inclusion. And so she walks the employees through different exercises and scenarios and you know, all of the content that she puts together to really help people to get in touch with their underlying biases and how that translates into certain sets of experiences for people of color. And so in the webinar, I envision that she's gonna shine a light on the role that white parents can play if we're going to eliminate racism by raising children who are anti-racist. And so, you know, when you have as many white parents think of themselves as nice people, and like we all think we're nice people, everybody, and therefore, there's nothing we could really do differently, like you, because they think more of the extreme incidents. Like, I would never, you know, call a black person that name or something like that. But they don't realize that the biases that they have can lead them to commit microaggressions as you go about your daily lives without realizing it. And it really shapes how you talk about people or events with your children, and then that in turn shapes their view of differences in race. So I think that that's what she's going to really help parents understand.
Okay. All right. I can't wait to hear that. I know I work with students selecting applying to colleges, and when we go to visit colleges, a lot of them talk about what they're doing to increase diversity on campus. But what I've noticed over the past couple of years is now they're not just looking to increase diversity of students coming to it, but they're realizing that there's so much more they need to do once the students get on campus in terms of making their environment more inclusive, because that's just part of it. Increasing that diversity, now you need to make the experience of diversity and inclusion for everyone on that campus. Mm-hmm. So it's nice to see colleges, you know, probably incorporating something like the things that Karen does with organizations. So I know, you know, we were discussing a while back in another conversation, we found it both interesting that, and perhaps somewhat comforting, to realize that much of what we've discussed that parents and children need in addressing social injustice and racism and becoming more of an anti-racist is somewhat incorporated on a broader scale in what we teach in PEP classes, in terms of the four C's, the feelings of courage, capability, connection, and making our children feel as if they count. How do you see the four C's applying to the concept of creating, you know, anti-racism?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think definitely the work and the attributes conveyed by those four C's really have a lot to do with how people come out and move in the world, really. Because I feel like racism at its root really has to do with fear and ignorance. So, you know, there's fear that the ideas that they have, that a person has about another group or another person that looks different from them, there's a fear that they're wrong about that. And there's a fear that it says something about them if they're wrong about that. And then there's just sometimes that fear holds them back from being able to learn more, from being willing to discover more. And so I think what we can do as parents with our children is it just starts really from the very beginning, helping our children, you know, through our interaction, our instruction, our exposure, that we can give our children an assurance that they matter and are valuable in this world. We can reinforce it by, you know, investing in them and teaching them life skills and allowing them to develop other skills that are related to school and other interests that they have, that they can, that can fill their toolkit and really help them feel capable. And so then those experiences can also help our children stretch and challenge themselves so that they really have faith and trust that they can rise up and meet situations courageously. And so when they're armed with these qualities, then they can really start, when you're comfortable with yourself, you just don't really have to reach out and hurt other people to make yourself feel good. So it just helps them to see other people, they have compassion for other people. And parents can do that by putting their children in situations where they see that their skills and their resources can be used to help mm-hmm. other people and not to harm other people. And so aside from those four C's I've talked about, another C, and that's for curiosity about other people. I mean, we have to, teach our children through, some of the experiences we've talked about today to really recognize and get comfortable with the fact that they're going to encounter people that are different from them. And mm-hmm. and those people will see them as different too. And so, it's very important for us to get to know each other and respect the differences and see them as just a different way, another way, maybe even another way. Of looking at things and not feeling that other people need to change to make mm-hmm. us feel comfortable. And so it's really about seeking first to understand, like you know, Stephen Covey would have said, and just being genuinely interested in other perspectives and other ideas. And that really is the definition of curiosity for me. And I think that is like a fifth C almost that
I like that. Yeah.
Things.
Yeah. We need a fifth C. We need a fifth C. If there were more of us who felt that courageousness, that curiosity and felt connected with others and as if we have, you know, that capability and we count the world, it makes us all walk through our world a little bit more confidently and certainly would offer more inclusivity. Where can people find you online?
Okay. So on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, I am at the Parenting 411. To learn more about what I do through the Parenting 411, you can visit carolmuleta.com. That's carolmuleta.com.
Many thanks to Carol Muleta, founder of the Parenting 411 radio talk show and PEP parent educator, for joining me today for PEP's Parenting During the Pandemic podcast. We invite you to participate in a wider conversation. Join us for PEP's Critical Topics and Parenting series of webinars that begin on August 24th and run through November. You can find more information and register at www.pepparent.org. Thanks again for joining us. I'm your host, Robbie Fox, and remember to have the courage to be imperfect.